sack. Is that all you get for your money? And if that's what you have in mind, yeah, if that's what you're all about, good luck moving up, 'cause I'm moving out.
Good morning and welcome to Oklahoma Real Estate on the Move. This is Mark Carr, team member of the Becky Ivins Real Estate Team, and I'm here on this day after Christmas with Becky Ivins, team leader.
Well, a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, Mark.
Merry Christmas to you, and Happy New Year's coming up, and to all of our Canadian Oklahomans, Happy Boxing Day.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Special meaning in our family.
Right. with Rob being the boxer.
Rob being the boxer.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So we're celebrating full force.
I don't think that's what Boxing Day means. I'm not really 100% accurate. I do have family that are Canadians, and they're a little...
I thought that was a British thing.
No, I think it's Canadian, but maybe it's both.
Ron Chalot.
Maybe it's both.
Set us straight here.
I'll help you out here. Yes, it is actually a British thing. Canada got it because, you know, Canada used to be a British colony, and a lot of the British colonies still celebrate Boxing Day. Happy Boxing Day, which has nothing to do with the pugilistic sport, by the way. Nor does it have anything to do with returning the Christmas gifts from yesterday. Nor does it have anything to do with packing up all the decorations and putting them in the attic. I used to think it was one of those, but it's not. Friend of mine at my church, in fact, my homily tomorrow will be on Boxing Day, but a friend of mine at church who's from England educated me on what Boxing Day is. It's where you give a Christmas box. It's actually the employer or the upper crust gives a Christmas box to the hired help, to the servants, even gives them a day off. And the Christmas box, what is it? It's a Christmas gift. So the box is a gift. So the Boxing Day is you give a Christmas gift to your non-relatives, to your servants, employees, things of that nature.
Oh, now all I've got to do is find some servants.
Step one in this process.
Yeah, right. Well, that's very interesting. I'll forever know that now.
See, that's why we love having Ron Chalot on here.
Until I forget
it. Wealth of knowledge.
Now, in Germany, Christmas actually begins Christmas Eve, because they open their presents on Christmas Eve, and it continues Christmas Day and even December 26th. So if you're in Germany, don't expect to get much on either Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, or the day after, because it's all celebrating Christmas. So Germany shuts down for that extended
Christmas period.
They do Christmas right.
And, you know, one of my sons was in the Ukraine for several months. And he said that they have Christmas villages everywhere. And they're little kind of pop-up flea markets, basically, or what do you call it, craft malls or something outside. And they string Christmas lights and people sell their wares. We've got some beautiful hand-carved and hand-painted Christmas things that he brought back for us from there. They're really quite advanced on that. The painting was terrific.
Yeah, for the past couple of years, I've been down to Midtown where they've done like pop-up shops and that little, which I love this time of year and have missed.
Well, they had it at Scissordale Park this year.
Oh, did they really?
They did.
I did not hear that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have a granddaughter who has a shop. It's called Trend Clothing. And they had a pop-up shop the 2 days, I think, after Saturday and Sunday after Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Down at Scissortail Park, and there were a lot of shops. Of course, pop-up shops in Oklahoma are where the wind comes sweeping down the plain. it was quite the scene with everything blowing around. But, well, let's take advantage of our guest today, okay? Take advantage of having the guest today. How's that? Ron Chalot is my attorney and our corporate attorney, and we depend on him to keep us up to date on all the laws and the way we ought to do things. And so, Ron, you come to us each year And we're going to do a two-part. You're going to be here next week as well. Of laws that have changed that affect us here in Oklahoma, right?
Well, I'm doing the next week because it's next year.
That's a whole different year. Okay.
So we'll be finally out of 2020.
Man.
Great.
I know that it's been quite the year.
It has been a year.
Yeah, for sure.
This year has felt like a year. So, it's felt like a decade, really, this year. But trying to remember, you know, I was here in February, and with the young teenager girl, and we were here, and that was right when this was just kind of getting started, this knowledge of the virus. And boy, that seems like a long time ago.
It does seem a very long time ago, doesn't it?
Oh, my goodness. My goodness. It's been a long year. There really haven't been a whole lot of statutes that affect the real estate or your type of business. So there really wasn't much to look at that way. But there have been some cases that were decided, and I pulled them out and took a look at them that might be of some interest. So just in a chronological order from the dates when they were announced. From February of last year, or this year, February 2020. And this is not something, anything that's really new, but it kind of reaffirms an old adage. You had a situation where a husband owned the property in his own name, married, and he deeded it over to husband and wife. And that was the concept. He deeded it. He signed the deed. This is in Oklahoma. Of course, then there began to be some issues, and the question that came up in the case is whether or not, because the husband had died, whether or not the property transfer was effective because just the husband signed the deed to the husband and wife. You remember, Becky, that in Oklahoma, that if you're going to transfer property and you're married, what happens?
There's marital interest.
And who has to sign the deed?
Both parties have to sign the deed.
That's right.
So even though that he signed the deed over to both parties, they could go, his offspring or his wife's offspring, I suppose, his wife's heirs could go back and claim.
Well, actually, it could theoretically, that was the question, would it invalidate the deed? And we've talked about this before, too, ever since we now have the same-sex marriage situation. This applies to all spouses, not just husband and wife, but whenever you have a spouse situation. So that was the question, what happens in that situation? Well, there is an exception to the rule. And the exception to the rule that where the husband or a spouse is signing the deed to that spouse and the other spouse, that is still a valid transfer. That does not invalidate the transfer. So it's an exception to that rule that both spouses have to sign the deed.
Well, that makes logical sense, which you would think that might not be the way the law is. Law doesn't always make logical sense, does it?
And it's the court has held that a spouse need not execute an instrument as a grantor where the same spouse is a grantee in the instrument. So that's interesting case out of the court. It was from the Court of Civil Appeals, which is our intermediate appellate court. It gets us back to that adage that we've always talked about, that how one transfers the property is vitally important. You have to have the right name, the right people, the right capacity, and is their capacity? Are they capable of transferring? You have to have the right instrument to convey, use the right words, and there has to be even a right reason, some type of consideration. So consequently, you have to have all those things, and how you transfer it is important. And of course, as we have said every time, I think I've been on here now for the past couple years, is you got to make sure who owns the property.
Yeah, in Oklahoma, they really protect that. You can't give away property, can't deed it without both spouses being involved within that. And so we'll talk more about this and as we come back with Oklahoma Real Estate on the Move, News Radio 1000, KTOK. Welcome back to Oklahoma Real Estate on the Move. This is Mark Carr, team member of Becky Ivins, and I'm here with Becky Ivins and her attorney, our attorney, Ron Chalot.
And, you know, if you want to find any of my favorite people, Ron being probably top of the list, all you have to do is go to BeckyIvins.com, and there's a tab on the page. I'm not sure where it is on the phone. I've not gone to my website on my phone.
Yeah, it has three little lines that that expand. You'll see on the should be on the top right of your phone, and you'll expand it out, and it'll say Becky's Favorites, and you click on Becky's Favorites.
And you're going to find my favorite people.
Yeah.
That you can use as a resource. That's why we bring them to light here.
And if you see something that you need that's not on the list, you can give us a call, 722-3232, 722-3232. We'd love to help you.
And, Ron, we were talking right before the break about a spouse needing to sign a deed, and because there could be a, I call it a marital interest.
Marital interest.
Okay.
Correct, yes.
And, you know, just because an attorney prepares it and just because it's done according to how the attorney perceives the law to be interpreted does not mean that a title insurance company has to write title insurance on it.
Well, they have their own title attorney who looks at the title and renders an opinion upon which the title company will rely, and that's why they pay them. And consequently, you at times have to talk to or even modify what you've done to satisfy the title attorney. And I've had a couple situations. I had one, back not too long ago, where we had a transfer of property and a minor child was involved. He had the interest under the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, and the custodian, who was also his mother, who also had an interest in the property, transferred it, sold it, transferred it, and the title attorney had an issue with that. So I had to talk to the title attorney. I had to show him that we had transferred some things before that were approved, show him some of the case law statute that I was looking at, and that one I did convince him, that title attorney, to go ahead and to approve that title, approve that transfer without contest. But I also had one several years ago where I had used some language in a probate transfer case. The title attorney that was looking at it, and this was in southeastern Oklahoma, told me that I did not use certain specific language, and consequently, he wasn't going to approve it. And I tried to tell him the language I used complied with the statute. In fact, was broader than the statute, but he wanted that specific language, those precise words in that order. So I went back and I did modify the order and put it to the point to where that title attorney was satisfied. And he apologized, but he said, I'm sorry, I've had this come up against me before, and so I'm always going to do this to everybody. So that does happen.
Are you anticipating or are you seeing a rise in title issues? Like we have so many do-it-your-own, do-it-on-your-own, the iBuyer, the for-sale-by-owner, all of those things, do they create greater title issues?
Well, usually your title issues are going to be because people aren't paying attention as to what they're doing. They're trying to do a lot of them themselves, but many of them aren't using whether attorneys or even the online services, but just trying to get the form off on the line and try to plug it in. I don't know if it's so much as title issues. Rather, it is they did something they did not really intend to do. For example, they did not create a joint tenancy with the right of survivorship. or they did create a joint tenancy with right of survivorship by putting one of their several children on it, thinking that that will fix everything, and it doesn't. It complicates things. Or putting multiple children on the title as well, which even more complicates things. So it's more the unintended consequences. What I also am seeing way too much, and I don't know if it's because these are just the cases that are coming to me or if they're all over the world, but cases where people have paid for and have put together a trust, one of the revocable living trusts, and their idea was to put their real property in it, but the real property never got there. Sometimes there is no deed that can be found at all, but there are some cases that I've seen, some matters I've seen, and it just really saddens me where there was a signed deed, but it never got filed and sometimes never even got notarized. So they had this deed to go into the trust and never completed the process.
Mm-hmm. So I see that a lot, frankly. I mean, it is my estimation is at least one out of four trusts that we deal with when we go list a property. That's a lot, isn't
it? That is a lot.
Well, sometimes there's a deed. Like we recently found one in a trust binder, but it was not ever filed of record. And then we've got another one that we had a deed where it was put into the trust, but nobody can find the trust or the memorandum of trust. So that we don't, that memorandum of trust needs to be filed with the deed when it's going from the trust to someone else, or frankly, I ended up finding that. I searched and searched and searched, and finally I found that it was filed when the trust was made. It was just filed all by itself.
Which would be normal, because you don't file the trust. The memorandum is a 1, 2, well, some are five.
This happened to be a seven-page memorandum, longest I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've seen them long, the long ones. I like to do one page, two at most, because you pay for each every page. But you don't have to put all that information in there. The idea of the memorandum is to give the world direction as to where to go with regard to the trust. Who do you talk to? Who's the warm body that you can go see that has the authority to act for the trust? That's what the memorandum is really telling you. And consequently, if you don't have that filed, we don't know if we've got the ABC Trust. Well, who has the authority to work for the ABC Trust? Or the Mark Carr Revocable Trust? Is it Mark Carr or is it somebody else? And you don't really know who without seeing the documentation. And that's what we're looking at or looking for. And I really, really stress for people who have trusts made for them, and even for lawyers that do them, to sit down and talk about the importance of keeping the trust, maintaining the trust, filing the memorandum, and filing the deeds. It's not that hard, and the lawyers should really strive to get involved in that. In fact, I nowadays tell them I won't even do it unless I am involved in filing the deed. I don't want to see somebody take my trust to another lawyer later on and found out the deed was never filed and therefore the trust is practically worthless. Why'd you spend all that money for?
If this is triggering questions for you and you want to ask Ron Shalott a question, give us a call, 405-840-1000. 405-840-1000. Ask Ron Shalott a question. It's a good time to use that.
You've got another law that has passed, right?
Well, I got another case to talk about. This was actually from August of 2019, but it was not reported until the 2020. And it has to do with the transfer on death deeds. We're talking about that a little bit, which is, of course, the Non-Testamentary Transfer of Property Act, where you can put on file a document that on your death will transfer the deed. The situation here was we had a transfer on death deed, and it caused some problems because the person didn't accept it. We'll talk about what's going to happen.
Oh, my goodness. Transfer, don't accept. Would that be, hear that after this news break. You're listening to Oklahoma Real Estate on the Move, News Radio 1000, KTOK. Welcome back to Oklahoma Real Estate on the Move. This is Mark Carr, team member of Becky Ivins' team, here with Becky Ivins and Ron Shalott, attorney at law.
And we are covering today things around real estate, laws that have changed or been modified this year, 2020, that affect the real estate industry and your buying and selling property or owning property. And we're talking about, right before the break, we kind of brought up the transfer on death deed, which is known as the TOD, right? Transfer on death deed, T-O-D-D.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
So,
it doesn't go through probate, so it's a non-testamentary transfer. It's like, you know, a life insurance policy pays off. It does not go through probate. It's not going through a trust, obviously, because there's no trust involved in it. But it is a conditional transfer, conditional in the sense that, first off, I have to still own it. Secondly, I have to die.
There you go.
So that's
has some conditions.
Yeah, has some conditions. But the beneficiary of it has no ownership interest, has no rights to it, has nothing to sell, nothing to give away. So the beneficiary really has nada until I die with the property being owned still by me at death.
Can you take it back? Like maybe you give it to one of your favorite nephews, and then that nephew screws up and you decide, well, I want to give it to the niece.
Yes, you can do that. You can revoke a transfer and death deed at any time. In fact, I did that. One of my first transfer and death deeds I did for a client of mine, she liked to change her will a lot, and within a few months she decided that wasn't a smart idea to have done a transfer and death deed, so we revoked it or rescinded it, and you had to file that of record because you do file the transfer and death deed in the county records.
If it's not filed, it's not valid?
It's not valid, no.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Correct. It has to be filed. And upon death, the beneficiary has 9 months to file for an acceptance. They file a form of acceptance along with a certified copy of the death certificate. At that point, the property transfers. But that's only if they file the acceptance.
What if they don't?
Well, that was this case. Funny you should ask that question. In this particular case, the person who was supposed to get the transfer on death did not file an acceptance. And to make it even more fun is the person who'd passed away, the decedent, had also made a will. And in his will, one of the things he did was made a specific provision to transfer the property to that same beneficiary, okay? That same beneficiary, we'll call him Jeff, okay? That beneficiary, Jeff, who was supposed to have gotten up that transfer and death deed but didn't accept it. The will said, well, the property will go to Jeff. But then he had a residuary clause, which is a catch-all safety net clause. Anything else I'm left with goes to, and it's split between kids. So if Jeff would be under the residuary clause, Jeff would only get a part of it. But if it's a specific bequest, Jeff gets all of it. Under the transfer and death deed, Jeff would have gotten all of it had Jeff in 9 months filed the acceptance. Jeff didn't file the acceptance. Transfer and death deed is no longer it's no longer valid as a transfer. So the question of this court was, does it go through the specific devise of the will or the residuary clause? The argument was is that, hey, if Jeff didn't get it then, it goes into the residuary clause because of the way the transfer and death deed is. Well, what do you think happened?
Well, I would think it said that it goes to Jeff.
And you would be correct because the court looked at it and decided that it doesn't go through the residuary clause of the estate, but instead it does go through the specific disposition clause in the estate. So Jeff does end up getting it, even though Jeff dropped the ball, so to speak. And the court talked about that a bit, that apparently the person who was giving the property, the decedent, really wanted to get this to Jeff, so he had a belt and suspenders approach. If this didn't work, then the other part would work. Maybe he knew Jeff might not do it.
But why wouldn't Jeff do that? why wouldn't Jeff not accept the property if there was a transfer on death deed?
It's quite possible that Jeff didn't know he had to do it. Then that happens more often than not. You may think it's automatic, or you may just not think about it at all. You don't talk to a lawyer. You don't want to spend the money, et cetera. And consequently, ends up costing you, or stuff goes on, and you wait a while, and you think, well, I'll get it later, or do something later about it, or find out what I need to do later, not knowing what you need to do. So you do need to file that acceptance.
I've run across that twice, that to where someone had a transfer on death deed, and they listed the property. They also had power of attorney over, one was a child, adult child, and one was a sibling. And they had power of attorney and talked. One of them actually was still living, and it was a shock to me when I got to closing, and there was something said that about this person still being alive. And the transfer on death deed, I mean, it was a big mess. And the title company, thank goodness, Chicago Title is who we like to use, and they have an attorney that got right on this, and it did not close when it was supposed to, but it did close a day or two later because they had to, they used the power of attorney as opposed to the transfer on death.
So the transfer on death was not valid because the person was not dead.
Right, even though I was led to believe that the person had deceased. They talked about this person in the past tense.
Wow.
And it was a sibling. And you know, things can get kind of complicated. So I learned. I asked the question now. So is your sister still living or is she deceased? Because people don't know about the transfer on death deed. They don't know they've got to go file that affidavit of public record in order to accept the property. And most people do not know, they're not aware, that a power of attorney is invalid after the principal dies.
After the death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They wanting to exercise this power. Well, I've got power of attorney. Well, I've got power of attorney. And I had siblings that did this after the death of a parent. Well, but I've got the power of attorney, and I just kept my mouth shut and let them just keep talking because I thought, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't going to get mixed up in that mess. So.
And you mentioned about the revoking the transfer and death deed. You cannot revoke it with a will only. It has to be a filed revocation. So just putting it in your will that I changed my mind does not revoke the transfer and death deed. Because what happens is that on the transfer and death deed, the death happens. It's a conditional transfer. If it's accepted, it end runs around or evades the estate. But if it's not timely accepted after that 9-month period, then it falls into the estate. So the transfer and death deed is no longer effective, but instead it goes into the estate, and then it's governed by, we hope, a will. But if there's not a will, then you've got a bigger problem because it's intestate succession without a will, and consequently it could go to someone you did not intend for it to go to. So that's a good lesson for all of us to make sure you dot your I's, cross your T's, and if there's a transfer and death deed, talk to a lawyer and get the thing figured out and done correctly.
Because do you know,
it's simple, but then it's complicated, and if you don't do it all the time, you're not sure what you're doing.
It can be simple if you have a good attorney, because then that attorney can tell you, well, by the way, your power of attorney is no longer valid, and this deed has to be accepted in order for you to get title to the property. I mean, there's different things that you need to know.
Yeah, it's impossible to know all the right things with the law, but it's good to know who to ask. And for us, it's Ron Shalhoub. It can be for you. You can find him at BeckyIvins.com. Click on Becky's Favorites, and it's time for our Word of the Day.
It is time for our word of the day, brought to you by Robbins Roofing, where their word every day is trust. You can trust Robbins Roofing for a small repair, to meet with your insurance claims guy or gal and get you everything you need on your insurance claim, or to put on a whole new roof, new decking, meet all the current codes. So Robbins Roofing, 728-3700. It's 728-3700.
The next two cases we're going to talk about have to do with what's called a pretermitted error.
Oh, yeah.
Well, say that again. I just kind of went back. What did he just say?
Everybody should see Becky's reaction to that. She rumpled her forehead, gave me this stunned look like, what are we talking about?
I don't think
about?
I've heard that.
Pretermitted error, P-R-E-T-E-R-M-I-T-T-E-D, pretermitted error.
Pretermitted, okay. Well, it has a pre in there. So.
Yeah, it has a pre. The verb is pretermit, by the way, from the Latin. And it means to pass by, to omit, to interrupt. We would, in English, would probably call it the forgotten error or the missed error.
Okay.
So pretermitted error is the forgotten error. And it really has to do with issue, with children. Forgotten children. Forgotten kid case.
Okay, well, yeah. We're going to talk about that when we return.
To Oklahoma Real Estate on the Move, News Radio 1000, KTOK. Welcome back to Oklahoma Real Estate on the Move. We're here with Ron Shalott talking all things law, learning some new vocabulary.
Okay. You've got some laws that have changed.
Well, not necessarily changed, more refined.
Okay.
We're a little smarter now than we were, say, a year ago. And we were talking about pretermitted error, the forgotten errors. Now, we can't go into all of the ins and outs of this because it is kind of complicated sometimes how this works. But just generally, what we're looking at is we're looking at the situation where an individual dies, leaving a will, and they provide for some, but not all of their children. Mm-hmm. So is the children forgotten? Did they just forget about them? They had a senior moment or for some reason were led the wrong way and forgot about this child and therefore didn't provide for them in the will. For example, you have a will which leaves things to Bob and Susie, but it doesn't even mention John or Betty, and all four of them are kids. So were John and Betty intentionally left out for a reason, or was it forgotten? So that's the question that comes up, the pretermitted error. It's a statute. And consequently, you have to look at whether or not there was a will, because if there's no will, it's intestate succession. And in one of the cases that we had a situation where an individual had left life insurance proceeds to some but not all the kids, and it was inconsistent with the will. So the children that weren't on the life insurance proceeds were going, wait a second, we are forgotten heirs. We're pretermitted heirs. We should be a part of the life insurance policy, part of the bank accounts, because the will would have given it to us. And so we are forgotten heirs, and that should apply in that situation. Well, the court said that heirs are not pretermitted, in other words, not forgotten, because the beneficiary status on a non-probate asset differs from a bequest in a will. Now, remember, if it passes by life insurance directly, just like the TOD, the transfer and death deed, or a pay on death clause, that is a non-probate asset. It doesn't go through an estate, doesn't go through probate. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court in February issued an opinion on it. They said very clearly that disposing of your property is an inalienable natural right through your lifetime. Okay? You got the right to do it. You got a right to give it away, to sell it during your lifetime. However, the method of disposition of property after death and the right of inheritance are statutory. So the legislature has statutes that say if you have a will as a means of disposing of your property at death, then it has to be done a certain way. And if you have forgotten someone, that could be a pretermitted heir situation. Okay? The question is whether the person who creates the will unintentionally failed to provide for or name in a will. It doesn't limit their power to dispose of their property during their lifetime or by another means, but it's an assurance that a child is not unintentionally omitted from a will. So what we need to do is we need to look at the will. Does the will identify who the children are, or does it specifically disinherit someone or disinherit even by class? And that's the forgotten heir situation in this, the situation of this particular case. Since it was not going through the probate, it was not considered a pretermitted heir situation. So it avoided the pretermitted heir statute. Sorry, all the kids don't get part of that in insurance policy or that bank account. And that's part of the doctrine of the pretermitted heir situation.
So the bank accounts where you name a beneficiary or more, that was one thing that we did this year.
Right.
That's probably the only thing we accomplished this year. But we went to a couple of banks where we have accounts, and we made sure that we had all four kids as beneficiary upon death. So long as we keep $4 in there, they'll each get a dollar, right?
True. But what if you only put one of them on? And some people do that where they'll put one child on there saying, well, they'll disperse it out.
Yeah. Well, but they don't have to. If
that
they get it.
That is the trick.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
That's the trick. And,
right.
And you can end up with a lawsuit over that as to, well, Dad intended or Mom intended this. And
boy, I think a lot of people this year have looked at updating their will, updating who's on the account, what is their intent. And there's a lot more to talk about, and Ron Shalhoub will be back next week to continue this conversation on Oklahoma Real Estate on the Move, News Radio 1000, KTOK.
Happy New Year.